You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, April 18th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, ladies and gentlemen, Ari Ravenhoff. On his book, Liars and, I had it right in front of me, folks. Lies Incorporated, The World Post-Truth Politics. The World of Post-Truth Politics. Pardon me. Also on the program today, Josh Fox. On his new film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. All that and more on today's program. I should tell you that the freebie half of the program is pre-recorded today. This is an interview I did with Ari last week, and the Josh Fox interview is an interview I did with him for Ring of Fire about 2 weeks ago. Josh is on the has been on the road and a little bit more difficult to pin down, and I am obviously headed to Vegas this week for the Mass Torts Conference, and then we're on vacation next week, so I wasn't able to record him again. But the interview that we did for Ring of Fire is great, and the film is it's really great. Of course, Josh made Gasland and Gasland 2, Academy Award nominated Gasland. Josh has been, we've done a couple of interviews with him on this program. You can find them in our archives. The most recent, I think we mentioned it in the interview, was that the last time I spoke to him, he was on a train heading back from Congress. I think in the shooting of Gasland Part 2, he was ejected from a hearing, and I spoke to him on the train. To keep that tradition up, I spoke to him in a car. He's in Florida on tour with this film. Ari, of course, is a host on Sirius XM and a longtime buddy. So you can check out the agenda if you have Sirius XM in your home or car. I don't know what channel it is on, and I forgot to ask him. But, I mean, you can find these things, folks. Come on. All right, Michael will be here to jump on in the fun half for members. So if you're a member, stick around. Tomorrow, Michael will be here doing the freebie show again on Wednesday. There will be no show in the feed today unless you are a member. If you're a member, you're going to get the talk I did with Iraqi college students there in Kurdistan. Fascinating. My talk was okay, but really what impressed me was the back and forth, the questioning from them, because I found them, I think, probably more fascinating and more interesting than they found me. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's not the case. I don't know. I think they enjoyed the back and forth. So members will get that on Wednesday, and members will also get a recap of Tuesday night's primary election in New York. Make sure you go out and vote, folks. Obviously, very important, regardless of who you're supporting. But particularly if you're supporting somebody whose initials are BS. But no, everybody go out and vote in the primary season. And if you're not a member, and I don't know why that would be the case, but I know there are literally thousands of you. In fact, tens of thousands of you. But there's also thousands of you who are members. Not tens of thousands of you who are members. But if you are one of those people who are not a member, but you want to hear Cliff and I go over Tuesday night's results, sign up for our email at majority.fm, because we're going to be sending out an email blast Wednesday morning or Wednesday afternoon, whenever it is after we record it. And in that email, you will get the ability to download this special show. And then on Thursday and Friday, I will be live from the Mass Torts Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. That is some folks' favorite set of shows. I go twice a year and interview lawyers who are involved in litigation against corporations who have done some pretty nasty things.
Hey, everybody. Michael here. Today's show is brought to you by Zip Recruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find the quality candidates you need. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post in all the job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Could not be easier to use. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And one more time, try it for free right now. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority.
All right, here is Ari Rabenhoff. Well, then we will go to music, and then Josh Fox. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the author, or I should say first, the host of The Agenda on Sirius XM Radio, the author of his most recent Lies Incorporated, The World of Post-Truth Politics, Ari Rabenhoff. Welcome to the program.
Sam, thanks for having me.
Where can people get the agenda, Ari?
They can get The Agenda on Sirius XM, so it's on channel 127 every morning, 6 a.m. East, 3 a.m. West. And shockingly, there does seem to be people listening in the West, because I do get West Coast callers in that first hour. I don't quite understand why they're up or why they haven't gone to sleep, but they do listen to The Agenda.
And maybe you'll give everybody listening now a free trial membership to Sirius XM. I'm joking. All right, let's get...
I think you can actually get one of those if you go to their website.
Oh, really? I had no idea.
Yeah.
All right, well, fair enough. And so people can do that if they want. But let's talk about your book, because there's a lot of... there's a lot of issues in here that, you know, we deal with on a daily basis, and you've done a great job of sort of like... of doing the TikTok and the details of how these these sort of almost zombie narratives in some way get born and live. In some cases, they die. But let's start with one which is very prominent at the moment, because I think it's come out by the time that this will air, that Time Magazine has a cover, and I imagine many people have already seen the cover by now, has a cover that's coming out. Dear Reader, it says on the top of the cover, it's a big red thing, you owe $42,998. And that's what every American man, woman, and child would need to pay to erase the $13.9 trillion U.S. debt. And there's a lot of lies. I mean, just putting aside the moment that the fact is that, you know, it's probably unlikely that if we were to have to pay off that debt in the way that their time is implying, that everybody would owe the same amount, since about 25% of the country's wealth is in the hands of about 3% of people. But putting that aside, there's a lot of other lies that involved around that notion of debt, isn't there?
Yes. And look, there's differences, right? There are policy disagreements, which we can have, right? And then there's basic information, which is untruthful. And the people who obsess about debt, right? Because most of the people who talk about debt most of the time do it as an excuse because they don't want to talk about something else. Meaning, right, talk to Republicans about the Iraq War, and they're like, oh, that deficit doesn't matter, right? In fact, Dick Cheney's quote, deficits don't matter, right? But then when a Democratic administration takes over, they're like, oh, my God, the deficit is out of control. Oh, this is the most awful thing in the world. That's most of it. Then there's a kind of small cadre of people, mainly based in Washington, who actually care about debt. And there's one guy, literally one guy. His name is Pete Peterson, right? And he has decided to spend $500 million of his own money trying to scare Americans about debt. And this effort and the people who they cite in Time Magazine are all about that issue. And they're all funded through him. Everything from the Simpsons-Bowles Commission, which I'm sure your audience knows about, the Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, who did they go kind of work for after they were done with the commission? Pete Peterson's foundations.
Right.
When people talk about Reinhart and Rogoff and their false study, which I talk about a lot in the book, which said that if these are two Ivy League elite professors who came out with a study that was not peer-reviewed, by the way, and that's an important point here, that said if your country's debt rises above a certain level, your GDP goes negative.
Well, we should make that clear. If it rises above a certain level of a percentage of your GDP.
Right. It goes negative. And I want to get to a lie that's not in the book, but actually important about that I kind of called out earlier this year after the book was done. But on this first thing, if you go negative, if you rise to a certain level, if you cross 90%, right, then your economy goes into the crap bin, right, is what they wanted to say. The problem is a grad student at UMass at University of Massachusetts found that their data was wrong,
right,
that they had miscoded their spreadsheet. And if you actually recalculated their spreadsheet, there really wasn't a widespread correlation between the idea of massive debts and economic problems. And this is because this goes against the entire notion that debt and deficits are a crisis that have to be dealt with. And the other problem is with these people is it's not that they think that debt and deficits are a crisis. It's how they want to deal with it, right? If you look at who's on their board, a lot of these people who participate in these activities are corporate CEOs who suck tons of money out of the Treasury through military contracts and tax schemes and all sorts of other things. But if you try to take those away, they all freak out. They want to fix the deficit by cutting things like Social Security, which has nothing to do with the deficit in the first place.
And, you know, just getting back to that Reinhardt and Rogoff study, I mean, this was the intellectual foundation for the turn to austerity in this country and, frankly, in many respects, internationally as well.
It actually had a larger effect in Europe, I would say, than in the United States, because we kind of edged austerity. We did some things that we shouldn't have done, like the sequester, and we had fights about how big the stimulus should be. Like, we edged austerity, right? Europe, a lot of places went full-scale austerity and felt the burn of it, because the problem is how you get out of deficits is not – you don't cut to get out of deficits. You grow to get out of deficits, right? And by putting yourself into austerity at a time when the world was in recession, you basically said, I'm going to shrink growth right now. And what's the obvious outcome? People get hurt. And that's actually the problem with the deficit hawks, is they refuse to acknowledge the consequence of their actions, and they base a lot of what they were talking about on this phony and flawed study.
And we should add, you know, Pete Peterson, I'm quite convinced, or I was quite convinced, that Pete Peterson was supporting Chris Christie, and that a big part of Chris Christie's attempt to run on the idea of cutting Social Security was a function of Pete Peterson. And just to remind people, he was the former Commerce Secretary, I think, under Richard Nixon. He was BlackRock investments that Pete Peterson, just a huge hedge funder, willing to drop.
That went public, and then he got all the money out of it when it went public, which is where he got his fortune. The interesting thing is he claims that his whole focus on deficits happened when he was cutting a real estate deal for a house in the Hamptons in the early 80s. And part of the deal that he signed to buy this house in the Hamptons was he had to speak at a Women's Republican Economic Club. And that's when he discovered that deficits are bad and we have to cut Social Security. Now, back in the 80s, there actually was a huge problem with Social Security that got fixed by Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan, and the Alan Greenspan Commission back then. Right, we actually did face a huge immediate crisis in the 1980s, but he hasn't kind of looked. The problem is are there times when deficits matter and we should talk about them? Yes, but it's not all the time, especially not during times of economic turmoil. And he also doesn't really believe in shared. He claims to believe in shared sacrifice, but all his solutions tend to overwhelmingly hit the poor.
Indeed. All right. So let's go to some other ones, because you the birth of lies, as you write in the book, or Lies Incorporated, really centered around tobacco. And this is, you know, the sort of the textbook case of an industry basically foisting its externalities on the taxpayer, the consumer, and then building an entire industry around lying about it.
Right. I mean, look, this is the thesis of the book. When you see these lies that emerge, these zombie lies, as we call them, I wrote this book because I became obsessed with where do these things come from, right? There has to be a lie, a zombie lie, just like a zombie apocalypse has to have a patient zero, right?
Right.
So I started looking at these lies and saying, who is the liar? Like, who is the liar? Because here's the problem. Pete Peterson's people, right, they write talking points and they give them to members of Congress. And most of the time you hear members of Congress saying something that's not true, they fully believe it's true, right? They've been given research by a staff member that's bad, a friend who happens to be a lobbyist told them something that's wrong. They aren't technically lying, because lying requires intent. But somewhere in the process, there has to be someone who invented the lie. And when I started looking, I found this small group of people who profit either ideologically or monetarily from the creation of lies. And they've created a very clear methodology for how you create a lie and inject it into the public consciousness and use it to stop progress on a number of issues. And if you look, the kind of inventor of this process is John Hill, who was the founder of the public relations firm Hill & Knowlton, which people might remember some of their greatest hits. In addition to the tobacco industry, they were the babies being thrown out of incubators lie at the start of the first Iraq War. They worked for the asbestos industry. They've done a whole – you want to look at, like, evil PR campaigns of the 20th century. you know, John Hill is that chapter of the encyclopedia. So John Hill meets with the barons of the tobacco industry in the 1950s, and they sit down, fancy hotel in New York, and he says to them, you're doing the wrong thing, because all the tobacco companies, people started to realize cigarettes were bad for your health, right? Mm. And John Hill, he actually realized cigarettes were bad for his health. You know how we know that? Because he quit smoking a few years before because he thought it was bad for his health. So they sit down, and they were marketing their cigarettes, and you can see these ads from the 1950s. Our cigarettes are the healthiest, right? That's how they were marketing them. And he said, no, no, no. You guys can't do that. You can't compete against each other in this way. What you need to do is go at the science that says you guys are, your product causes cancer. Now, his research, the research on tobacco and cancer dates back actually 30 years at that point. And we were pretty sure come 1960 that, you know, as sure as we are of climate change now, that tobacco smoking caused lung cancer. And you actually see this. There's a letter to the editor of The Atlantic after one of the PR, the doctors employed by the tobacco industry denied the link. There's a letter from a doctor from Harvard that I found in The Atlantic that's like, how can you be denying this? Like, the science is clear. But they used a methodology that we see today most prominently with climate change to deny it. And that's that. Now, the thing is, if it was just tobacco and climate change, we'd have a singular story. But I started looking at the entire Obama administration, and every single major issue that Barack Obama dealt with during his administration, so health care, Betsy McCoy and death panels, climate, like we don't even need to go over the reams of lies about that, immigration, there's a whole network of liars set up on the immigration, in the immigration debate, debt and deficits, we talked about Reinhard Rogoff and the attempt to turn us towards austerity. Voting rights, there's a guy named Hans von Spakovsky, which, by the way, is a great name for a movie villain, but he's actually a real-life villain whose entire goal for the past 16 years has been stripping Americans, has been disenfranchising voters. And he does that primarily based on lies.
Let's talk, I mean, go into some detail about von Spakovsky, because I remember he was one of the U.S. attorneys caught up a little bit, I think, if I remember correctly, in the U.S. attorney scandal under George W. Bush.
That was kind of tangentially related. Hans von Spakovsky was a Georgia kind of local figure who joined the Bush camp, the George W. Bush campaign, and was part of the, like, of the Brooks Brothers riots in Florida in 2000. He goes with Bush, the Bush administration, to the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, and Voting Rights Division, where he basically halts a whole bunch and politicizes that division. So when he gets appointed to the Federal Elections Commission by Bush, he's actually and Federal Election Commission appointments are rarely rejected because they're done in pairs. So when you do them, you put a Democrat and Republican up at the same time. His was rejected because he was such a bad actor at the Department of Justice. He goes to the Heritage Foundation and becomes kind of this person arguing for voter ID and all that. And if you look at people who study this, they say Hans von Spakovsky is the patient zero. And he does this by literally at every opportunity possible lying about the problem of voter fraud. And every time he talks, oh, this is a voter fraud problem. If you dig in, it just wasn't a voter fraud problem. Now, this was a part of the Bush administration because the the U.S. attorney scandal started when a number of U.S. attorneys, specifically one U.S. attorney in Arizona, who received awards for his voter fraud work, was not prosecuting Democrats vigorously enough on voter fraud. And so the justice, because there weren't any cases. And so Karl Rove tried to have him, and under political pressure, had him fired. And that's kind of the tangential relationship here. He has become the kind of centerpiece of lies about the voting rights. And if you look at all these efforts to push voter ID laws, they very much begin with him.
I mean, there's, I mean, in each of these sort of issue silos, there seems to be, like you say, there's a, you sort of identify, I guess, the patient zero, if you will, and just healthcare. It's Betsy McCaffey in terms of the or McCaffey in terms of the death panel and whatnot. Is on the next level, right, of sort of, I guess, amplifying these lies and, you know, I guess, providing the conduit so that they infect the body politic. Are the players the same? Is the money coming from the same place, or does it vary on the issue set?
I mean, it varies on the issue set, but it's within the same goals and the same strategies, and there's kind of a learning curve that people are clearly using the same tactics. And there's a kind of other layer, which is always the connector, you kind of call it. So on the issue of LGBT rights, another example where a guy named Mark Regnerus wrote a completely phony study claiming that the children of gay parents have worse outcomes in life than the children of straight individuals, right? And this was used in court by the House of Representatives when they defended DOMA. It was used by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. It was used repeatedly, right? The study, can I curse, by the way? What are the rules?
A curse.
Okay. The study, when reviewed, was published. The journal that published it hired somebody, a professor from the outside, to review how they ended up publishing this. And the Chronicle of Higher Education, not known for its outlandish and incendiary quotes, they went to the guy and they said, "What do you think of this study?" And he goes, "The study was bullshit." That's, and those funny. Were his, it's bullshit. Like, and that's a sociologist talking, was like, to another sociologist. The American Sociological Association condemned the study. His own department distanced themselves from the study. So he received a $700,000 grant to do the study from an organization called Witherspoon, which is founded by a guy named Robert George, who, if you look, is on the board or at the center of literally every major anti-gay group in the country. Now, who is Robert George? He's a Princeton professor, very well-respected, highly liked Princeton professor, who is a kind of, who does all, is very Catholic, and bases a lot of his research and scholarship on kind of Catholic theology. He's so respected that, for example, when Pope Benedict visited the United States, he was one of the few people who received a private audience with the Pope.
Wow.
You have bishops in the United States who say, "Before I turn to make a public pronouncement, I always talk to Robert George." Like, this is a widely respected guy. He's done numerous studies on a variety of different theological things, has substantially written about how masturbation is a great moral evil, by the way.
That can cut both ways.
Maybe that's where Ted Cruz got it from. So he is kind of the connector of this world. And he helps, you know, this foundation paid $700,000 for this University of Texas study by this professor, but it also needs to flow through that world, right, through the National Organization for Marriage, the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Commission. And by the way, Robert George has served in administrative posts, I think, for every president since Clinton.
Wow.
Because Republicans keep appointing him in their slots on different boards, Civil Rights Commission, et cetera, where he always just wreaks havoc, basically.
Wow. And so there's always a figure like this. I mean, give me one more guy that stood out for you, or woman, that stood out for you as being particularly egregious.
I mean, egregious, they're all egregious, right? They're all, you know, Betsy McCoy is probably the most egregious, the woman who invented the death panel smear. The most interesting character to me is actually a guy named John Tanton. And John Tanton is an ophthalmologist in northern Michigan, and he's another one of these connectors. And he is at the center of the entire anti-immigrant movement in this country, is him. Like, every major group was founded or funded by him at one point or another. And what's interesting about him is he was a liberal. Right, he was a Planned Parenthood Sierra Club guy in the 70s who became anti-immigrant, claiming that immigrants are destroying the environment in our country, and kind of became a right-wing anti-immigrant bigot.
How does that argument go, that the immigrants are destroying the environment?
He said that, you know, our birth rates are flat. The only people who are coming here are immigrants, so they must be destroying our environment. This was not actually uncommon in some of the environmental community in the 70s. There actually was a major fight about this inside the Sierra Club, but he ended up leaving those organizations because they didn't become anti-immigrant. He wanted Planned Parenthood and the Sierra Club to turn anti-immigrant. They didn't. He left and started founding his own organization. So FAIR, which is a big anti-immigrant organization, not the media watchdog, the anti-immigrant organization. They're two different organizations. Is one of them. Numbers USA, which you see ads for on TV, is another of his organizations. The Center for – he has a think tank that does studies, you know. And by the way, all of his stuff has links to some white nationalist groups, et cetera, of course. He's just a fascinating figure because you see this – you know, Robert George in the LGBT movement, this is a major intellectual figure at one of the most prestigious universities in the country, right? John Tanton is an ophthalmologist in northern Michigan. Like, the fact that he could become the center of this movement is actually pretty incredible.
That is amazing. Lies Incorporated, ladies and gentlemen, the world of post-truth politics. Ari Rabenhoff, we will put a link at majority.fm to the book. Ari, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Sam, thank you. Everybody go buy the book and keep listening to the Majority Report.
Thank you. So, Josh, I had the opportunity to screen the film, and I really loved it. And it's a little bit. I mean, it's a little bit different than your past films in some respects. The first, I don't know, third of the film, I guess maybe, starts out where you are sort of. Following the moments after the victory that you had, and we all had in some ways, of fracking not coming to your neck of the woods in upstate New York, but then essentially you moved on to the I guess in some ways a bigger and more pressing issue.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. You know, it is a very different movie, I think, in its spirit and in its tone than the Gasland films, although I do think it sort of serves as the unofficial third and final chapter of the trilogy of the Gasland films. But it is a very different film. I feel much more exposed emotionally in it. I'm get sucked into it in a whole other way, which I can't control. You know, it's a very, very deeply emotional movie. And yeah, you're right. It's at first it's this victory celebration. We won against fracking in the Upper Delaware River Basin. We saved the watershed. The citizens really mattered and beat the biggest industry on the face of the earth. But then you quickly realize that we could win everything. We could win our own backyard back from the frackers and still lose everything that we love to climate change. And I don't mean just everything we love in our area, but everything in the world to climate change. And that, you know, when you're working on issues of fossil fuel development, as I have been with fracking, although it's a very immediate, visceral threat, these rigs are coming to your backyard, the much greater threat is fossil fuel, is climate change from fossil fuels. And that becomes so clear to me when I realize that the forest all around me, which the keystone species is the hemlock tree. The hemlock tree determines how that forest and how that ecosystem works. And the hemlock trees are being eaten by a parasite that is advancing up the East Coast all the way from Virginia to Maine, called the woolly adelgid. And it's advancing because climate change is changing the temperature. And it's allowing that such important part of our forests, the iconic forests of the East, to die. And that is extraordinarily alarming. Right after that, New York City gets slammed by Hurricane Sandy. So you get this 1-2 punch. You see how in trouble our forests are along the East Coast. And then Hurricane Sandy, the largest storm ever to hit the East Coast of America, hits. And it is a 1-2 punch that just sends me full on into an investigation on climate change.
And we should say that in some ways, you know, those two different types, sort of categories of fallout from climate change encompass what Michael Mann was talking about when he said that he describes the four apocalypse, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, because, you know, you have that sort of the sort of quieter, lower level implications of warming happening, that, you know, whether it's, you know, just even things like, ticks and deer and yes. Lyme disease moving yes. north and across the country because yes. of these bacterias and other all sorts of different sort of bacterial problems and ecosystem mm-hmm. problems that are, you know, not as as violent in some ways, or at least as prominent or I guess acute as something like Hurricane Sandy or right. You know, consistent flooding in certain areas, and so this takes you down this road where you quickly hit the end of the line where there's this I don't know, it's sort of the hopelessness I guess.
Yeah, well, I hit the wall at 100 miles an hour. It's like, you know, there's this funny moment in that sequence where it's a montage of all these different experts, and they're incredible people: Bill McKibben, Michael Mann, Elizabeth Colbert, Lester Brown, Van Jones, and they're all saying just how bad things are and how we're in such dire circumstances. It's too late in many aspects. And there's this funny moment where Michael Mann is talking about how climate change, when he talks about climate change, he talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and every one of them being manifestations of climate change: war, famine. And then he talks about disease and how dengue fever is on the rise. Look at what's happening with the Zika virus. And in the Northeast, yes, the proliferation of ticks and Lyme disease. All these migration of tropical diseases coming into non-tropical regions. And I get kind of confused in the interview. I say, wait a minute, which horseman was that? And he just sort of deadpans and goes, death, pestilence and death. And it's kind of a funny, I mean, it's so upsetting, but it's kind of weirdly hilarious at the same time. And we cut to a montage of these experts who are totally silent, jaw dropped, despondent. And yeah, I quit the movie at that point. I basically let the camera fly away in the middle of a slow snowstorm and say, I'm done. I can't go on. I can't move on. And it's sort of like that weird moment in a Beckett play where I can't go on. I must go on. And I asked the question, you know, when you're making a movie, you have to ask an active question. And the active question of this movie is not, what is climate change and is it real? I mean, that's an ant. We know that already. The active question in this is, what are all the things climate can't change? We just went over the fact that climate change is probably going to destroy our major coastal cities. It's going to wipe out 30 to 50% of the species on the planet. It's going to cause increased drought, increased flood, increased famine and starvation, increased infectious diseases, wildfires, tornadoes, hurricanes, rising sea levels. We've just talked about all of that. And what are the things that climate can't change? And how do we start to think about that? What's so deep inside of us that no storm can take those things away? And that's the investigation for the second part of the film. And that takes me all over the world to meet with indigenous environmental monitors in the Amazon or the Pacific climate warriors, these incredible warriors on hand-carved traditional canoes that paddle out into the Gulf of Newcastle to stop coal ships in Australia, to people fighting for human rights and environmental protections in China, even at pain of their own civil liberties being dissolved. You know, really remarkable, to Tim DeChristopher, who went to jail for 2 years to stop an oil and gas auction, illegal oil and gas auction in Utah. I mean, incredible examples of human fortitude, of resilience, of love, of community building, of democracy, of human rights. And these are the things that climate can't change. So the second half of the movie really becomes a celebration of all the things that are worth fighting for, of all the things that we have left. And this is, in fact, what would make human beings worth keeping on the planet: music, art, culture, dance. And it does it in such a way, I think, that is very surprising and unusually energizing. So people, we've been doing this film. We're on tour right now. I'm in
Well, Josh,
Florida.
Let's take a break because
sure.
I want to come back. I want to talk about that aspect of it, that it is both sort of both hopeful and sad simultaneously in many respects, and we'll talk about that. We're talking to Josh Fox. He is literally on tour as we speak, we will continue talking about how to let go of the world and love all the things climate change can't change.
Yeah,
we'll be right back after this. So, Josh, you are on tour at the moment with How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. Leading up, I guess, until its debut on HBO. And it's a bit of a departure for you. And let me ask you about that moment in the film where you illustrate it with these sort of blank looks from these climate change experts, where the conversation sort of ends as you're pursuing of what is the future going to look like. I'm reminded of an interview I saw a long time ago with a Dr. James Lovelock from Britain, who was the guy who found the hole in the ozone layer. And they were asking him, this is 10 or 12 years ago, about climate change. And he said, oh, yeah, this is a conversation we should have had about 30 years from now. We're looking at perhaps 80% of a decrease in human population by, within a century or so, and fairly despondent. I think he sort of walked that back because that's a very sort of difficult, and this is one of the things that I mentioned. Yeah. When I talk to people like Bill McKibben, who you interview in your film, or Michael Mann, for that matter, it's like, well, what do we do? How do you keep from getting despondent over this? And your answer was to go find people who are fighting this regardless of the odds that are arrayed against them.
Well, that's true. And I also wanted to find it in myself. I mean, what's the point of making a movie about climate change if all the experts are saying we have no recourse, or our recourse is very slim and things are looking really bad, And I think there is a point, but I had to find it. I had to discover it. That was the question. And I think a lot of climate activists and just people in general are in that strange spot of this ping pong between despair and denial, and that's a kind of schizophrenic state. And this is an answer to that question. And I think that's the beautiful thing about the people in the film, the subjects of the film. They don't have time for that. It's like we're acting now. We're acting on our convictions now. And I think in many ways the movie becomes a value movie, a spiritual movie in the guise of a political film. It's saying we've got to celebrate a different type of instinct inside of us. Our society right now is based on greed, on competition, and on violence. That's what runs the world. And if we're going to survive or retain our humanity going into the climate calamity, we have to start basing what we do on different values, on generosity, on resilience, on innovation, on civil disobedience and democracy and human rights, on creativity. I think about this a lot when I think about Hurricane Katrina. And when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, it flooded that city, and there was only one way out of the city for its mostly black and poorer residents, which was to get out on this bridge. And there was a march across the bridge. The mayor said, get out of the city, walk across the bridge. And the white police force on the other side of that bridge in the suburbs met them with shotguns and said, go back and drown. Now, that wasn't a climate problem. That was a human failing. That was a collapse of American values. That was a collapse of human rights. That was not climate. That was people. And if we're going to go ahead, I think we have to think about that. Don't get your extra shotgun and your extra rounds of ammunition ready. Get the spare bedroom ready. Make sure you have a meal for the people who may be coming to your door. Welcome our fellow human beings with open arms. That's what I'm trying to talk about. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes, many, many things. We were just in Miami on tour. We might lose all of Miami. But what is Miami? Miami is just stuff. The people of Miami is what makes Miami. If Shakespeare wrote, what is the city but the people? The people are what matter. We have to start to understand that we have to act with kindness towards each other. And that's the core message of the film. And that's the beautiful thing that I'm seeing in America in all these movements, the movement against climate change, the movement against fracking, the movement for Black Lives Matter, the movement to elect Bernie Sanders, Occupy movement. These movements have different hallmark, different, principles that are guiding them. There's a paradigm shift inside of those movements. We can give love. We can give generosity. We don't have to live inside the paradigm that created climate change. Climate change is created by inequality. I just read in The Guardian, 50% of global emissions are caused by the top 10%. 1 hour in a private jet is the same emissions as a whole year in your car. So,
and in many respects, problems, You can see that. I mean, you make that point as you travel. I think it was in Beijing, and you're in a factory,
right.
And looking at you talk about these shirts that'll end up in Walmart, and we think of it. I think you said is we think of it as Chinese manufacturing, but it's really American manufacturing that we just simply. It's a huge not in my backyard. But sadly, it's adjacent to our backyard when it comes to the environment, because we're just doing it somewhere else, and it is causing this problem.
It's unfair to say, look at Chinese emissions, when what the Chinese factories are making are products for everyone around the world. Everyone who's buying those products participates in those emissions.
Right.
So we wanted to take huge photographs of coal-fired power plants and put them in front of Walmart to show that these Chinese people are suffering from, you know, our habits of consumption, especially if it's a thing that you're going to buy right now and throw away in 6 months and it'll end up in the ocean as another piece of plastic debris. So we have to examine this. But what I'm saying is we actually are examining it. It's happening in all the places where people are fighting climate change. It's an incredibly exciting time to be in America right now. I mean, America is an oligarchy. It is ruled by oligarchs. It is ruled by the people who are buying our government on a daily basis with millions and billions of dollars. However, America is also this nation of movements which are operating on an entirely different set of principles, on a totally different paradigm. And that movement is awake and thriving. And a lot of that is what's portrayed in the film, right, without being in those terms. But, I mean, that is what Occupy Sandy was, when 25,000 volunteers a day were streaming into churches and community centers in New York City to provide mutual aid for other people in New York. That is an amazing thing. And that is what I see in America right now, which is why we're on tour. We're doing the Let Go and Love tour for How to Let Go of the World and Love All This Climate Can't Change. And the Let Go and Love tour is going to all those places that are fighting the fossil fuel industry tooth and nail, fighting pipelines, fighting power plants, fighting compressor stations, fighting onshore fracking, offshore drilling, offshore fracking. I mean, America is fighting the fossil fuel industry in every single corner of every state. So we're taking the movie to those people for free. That's what we're doing on the road right now. We'll be doing that all the way up until the time when HBO puts the film on. At June 27th is when it'll premiere on HBO. We're also doing a few theaters, so there are places where you could do the whole go to the movies and pay for a ticket, which really helps us a lot if you do that in New York.
Where can
Los
people
Angeles.
Get information? Where can people go online to get more information about where to see How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change?
many places on our website, which is howtoletgomovie.com, howtoletgomovie.com. And we have a Facebook page for How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. Also, there's the Gasland page, which we're posting a lot of things to. There's a lot of followers there. But I would suggest going to the website or going to Facebook and really finding out where we're going on tour. The tour events have been absolutely amazing. People dancing in the aisles, great question and answer discussions, access to renewable energy that we provide people. They've been astounding. So that's a great context to see the film. And of course, we're encouraging people to have house parties when we do the HBO broadcast, to invite people over if you have HBO, or invite yourself over to your friend's house who has HBO and watch the movie.
Well, the film, I found it stunning images.
Thanks.
And it's both sort of a road movie that is incredibly inspiring, also, you know, a little scary and disturbing. Those images, particularly in Beijing, are just absolutely, folks got to head over to the website, find out where you can see a screening. Josh Fox, thanks so much for your time today. Please drive carefully.
Thanks, Sam. Always a pleasure.
Well, we're all doomed. And I'm Michael Brooks, and this is the Majority Report. We're about to jump into the fun half, everybody. I will be here tomorrow to have a conversation, an in-depth conversation, about what's happening in Brazil. I think we have somebody, a Brazilian professor who's located in the UK, but I'll have that confirmed soon. So we're going to jump right to the fun half. First, obviously, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Write us a review on iTunes. It makes a big difference. JustCoffee.coop. And as a matter of fact, where is this Just Coffee deal?
I know. It's MRSpring16 for 30% off of your Just Coffee orders.
MR Spring 16 for 30% off of your Just Coffee orders for this month of April. That's an incredible deal. Obviously, Majority Report kickback for Amazon.com and Jet.com. Using our link, we get a little bit of a kickback. And we got a bunch of sound for you. You can join us 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. See everybody in the fun half.